This CLE course is based on decisions released in June 2019 by our New York State appellate courts dealing with negligence issues. Those selected decisions were summarized. The summaries were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in June of 2019. And those summaries have since been compiled in a June 2019 negligence update pamphlet. And it is that pamphlet that constitutes the written materials for this June 2019 negligence update CLE. The first case in the June 2019 negligence pamphlet on page 8, the Ramos case, it deals with the concept of assumption of risk. Second Department held that plaintiff assumed the risk of injury by participating in a monster climb, knowing she could fall, and knowing there were no protective mats. The event was an obstacle course race sponsored by defendants and held at a public park. The court wrote, the plaintiffs argued that the assumption of risk doctrine cannot apply unless the sport or recreational activity takes place at a permanent designated facility. They also argued that there were triable issues of fact as to whether the defendants unreasonably increased the risk of the monster climb obstacle by erecting it on a roadway without protective mats underneath, by allowing an unlimited number of participants on the obstacle's cargo nets at the same time, and by having staffers shout at the injured plaintiff to turn her body and hurry up. The court went on, if the risks of the activity are fully comprehended or perfectly obvious, plaintiff has consented to them and defendant has performed its duty. Risks which are commonly encountered or inherent in a sport, as well as risks involving less than optimal conditions, are risks which participants have accepted or are encompassed by the assumption of risk doctrine. It is not necessary that the injured plaintiff have foreseen the exact manner in which his or her injury occurred, so long as he or she is aware of the potential for injury, of the mechanism from which the injury results. A participant's awareness of risk is to be assessed against the background of the skill and experience of the particular plaintiff. Next is Petrie versus Golden Touch Transportation of New York. It deals with the standard of care applied to common carriers. Second Department held that the common carrier's motion for summary judgment in this personal injury case should have been granted. Plaintiff alleged injury caused when defendant's van hit an expansion joint in the highway. The court wrote, to establish a prima facie case of negligence against a common carrier for injuries sustained by a passenger as a result of the movement of the vehicle, the plaintiff must establish that the movement consisted of a jerk or lurch that was unusual and violent. There must be evidence that the movement of the vehicle was of a different class than the jerks and jolts commonly experienced in city bus travel, and therefore attributable to the negligence of the defendant. Here the defendant established its prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law through its submission of the deposition testimony of the plaintiff, who testified that the van in which he was a passenger was constantly jostled up and down, and that when the van hit one of the expansion joints in the highway, he heard something in his neck snap. The plaintiff admitted that his body was not physically moving up and down, and that the bumps and jolts of the van were only putting pressure on his lower back. Therefore, the evidence established that the movement of the van at issue was not unusual and violent. Next case is on page 9, MC versus City of New York. It's an action by a student who was assaulted, an action against the school. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that discovery in this third-party assault or negligent supervision case should not have been restricted to prior sexual assaults in the school and prior assaults between the perpetrator and the student plaintiff. The court wrote, "We disagree with the Supreme Court's determination that the defendants were only required to provide records pertaining to assaults of a sexual nature and all assaults of any nature between the infant plaintiff and the student alleged to have sexually assaulted the infant plaintiff. Evidence of prior assaults at the school, particularly any assaults in the stairwell where the subject incident occurred, may be sufficient to establish that the defendants had actual or constructive notice of conduct similar to the subject incident. Moreover, evidence of any prior assaults by the offending student against students other than the infant plaintiff may be sufficient to establish that the defendants had actual or constructive notice of the offending student's dangerous propensities." Next on page 10, it's BT versus Bethpage Union Free School District. It's another negligent supervision case against the school. Second Department held that the school district's motion for summary judgment in this negligent supervision action was properly denied. The gym teacher told the students to run around the perimeter of the building, and according to the student plaintiff, some students were jumping over a chain. The student plaintiff attempted to jump over the chain when she tripped and fell. The court wrote, "The infant plaintiff testified at her deposition that the gym teacher did not instruct her not to jump over anything and that approximately 20 students jumped over the chain before she attempted to do so. She initially did not know what the other students were jumping over, and she realized that they were jumping over the chain when she was approximately 5 feet away. The infant plaintiff was still jogging at that point. She did not see the chain until she was very close to it because the chain blended in. The gym teacher testified at his deposition that the students usually ran on a grassy area around the perimeter of a field. On the day of the accident, however, he instructed the infant plaintiff and her classmates to run around the perimeter of the school building because the grassy area was too wet and muddy. He had never before instructed that class to run around the perimeter of the building. The gym teacher also testified that he instructed the students to avoid the chain, that he ran behind the students, and that when he reached the chain, he observed students running around it. The school district failed to demonstrate prima facie that it provided adequate supervision or that a lack of adequate supervision was not a proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries. Next is Douglas F. on page 11. It's another suit against a school district, this time based upon a dangerous condition in the school. Fourth Department held the motion to set aside the negligence verdict against the school district was properly denied. Plaintiff student was injured by a bathroom door which opened outward into the hallway on the side of the hallway the students were instructed to use. Court wrote, "The director of facilities for defendant Williamsville Central School District at the time of the incident testified that it was very possible that the outward swinging door could strike someone walking down the hallway, that he did not know of any reason why the door opened outward, and that the door could have been modified by his staff in a short time at minimal expense. Even apart from the testimony of the expert, there is legally sufficient evidence from which the jury could conclude, based on common sense and the ordinary experience and knowledge possessed by laypersons, that the outward opening door was not reasonably safe." Next is Stephanie on pages 11 and 12. It's a case that construes the evidentiary requirements under the Federal Employers Liability Act. In this case, the plaintiff was a conductor on the defendant railroad, and the Federal Employer Liability Act, or FELA, applied to her. First Department held the defendant railroad's motion for summary judgment in this Federal Employers Liability Act action by a railroad employee assaulted by a passenger was properly denied. The court explained the evidentiary criteria under the Federal Employers Liability Act. The court wrote, "The Federal Employers Liability Act, which is 45 U.S.C. Section 51 et sec, provides that operators of interstate railroads shall be liable to their employees for on-the-job injuries resulting from the railroad's negligence. In an action under the Federal Employees Liability Act, Employers Liability Act, the plaintiff must prove the traditional common law elements of negligence: duty, breach, damages, causation, and foreseeability. However, these elements are substantially relaxed, and negligence is liberally construed to effectuate the statute's broadly remedial intended function. A claim under the FELA must be determined by the jury if there is any question as to whether employer negligence played a part, however small, in producing plaintiff's injury. A case is deemed unworthy of submission to a jury only if evidence of negligence is so thin that on a judicial appraisal, the only conclusion that could be drawn is that negligence by the employer could have played no part in an employee's injury. To establish the element of foreseeability, a plaintiff must show that the defendant had either actual or constructive notice of the defective condition. However, notice generally presents an issue of fact for the jury. As with all issues under the FELA, the right of the jury to pass on this issue must be liberally construed, with the jury's power to draw inferences greater than in a common law action. Under the foregoing relaxed standard, there is sufficient evidence to raise an issue of fact concerning defendant's actual or constructive notice of a risk of assault to conductors on the New Haven line. Plaintiff testified that she was previously assaulted by a passenger and that there was an ongoing problem of physical intimidation by large groups of adolescents refusing to pay their fares, which caused her to fear for her safety. Plaintiff also testified that she has called the MTA's rail traffic controllers for police assistance at least 250 times to deal with abusive passengers. Another conductor was punched in the face and knocked out on the New Haven line. A passenger attempted to stab and rob another conductor on the Harlem line. Next is the Short case on pages 12 and 13. It's a school employee's negligence action against the school based on a dangerous condition. And the question was whether the negligence lawsuit was somehow prohibited because the employee did not exhaust her remedies under the collective bargaining agreement. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held an employee's personal injury complaint against the New York City Department of Education stemming from an elevator accident should not have been dismissed. The plaintiff employee first applied to the Department of Education for line-of-duty injury paid medical leave pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement and was denied. Plaintiff then commenced the personal injury action. The Department of Education argued that plaintiff had failed to exhaust the administrative remedies required by the collective bargaining agreement, and in the alternative, the denial of the line of duty pay should be given res judicata or collateral estoppel effect. Supreme Court decided plaintiff had failed to exhaust the administrative remedies. The Second Department held that her injury and the resulting negligence action were not covered by the collective bargaining agreement. The court wrote, "The plaintiff seeks to recover damages against the defendants for pain and suffering based upon a negligence theory of liability which is outside the scope of and is not governed by the collective bargaining agreement's line of duty injury paid leave grievance provisions. There is no need to exhaust administrative remedies when the cause of action by the plaintiff is not governed by the collective bargaining agreement. Collateral estoppel is inapplicable as the defendants failed to demonstrate that the issue that the plaintiff seeks to pursue here was necessarily decided by the Department of Education when it denied the plaintiff's line of duty injury paid leave application. Likewise, the doctrine of res judicata or claim preclusion also is inapplicable to the plaintiff's complaint because the relief she seeks could not have been awarded within the context of the prior administrative proceeding." Next is the Walden Bailey chiropractic case on page 13. It's a case that involves employment law, liability of the employer, and also the pleading requirements for a prima facie tort. The Fourth Department held plaintiff's negligent hiring and supervision and prima facie tort causes of action should have been dismissed. The lawsuit alleged defendant insurer failed to pay claims for medical care submitted by the plaintiff. The court wrote, an employer may be liable for a claim of negligent hiring or supervision if an employee commits an independent act of negligence outside the scope of employment and the employer was aware of or reasonably should have foreseen the employee's propensity to commit such an act. Here, plaintiff's cause of action for negligent hiring, supervision, or retention is based on the factual allegations that defendant's employees denied or delayed the payment of claims to plaintiff and sent repetitive verification demands, and that defendant was aware of what its employees were doing and continued to employ them. Plaintiff, however, failed to allege that those acts were committed outside the scope of the employee's employment. Turning to the prima facie tort cause of action, the court said, there can be no recovery for prima facie tort unless a disinterested malevolence to injure the plaintiff constitutes the sole motivation for defendant's otherwise lawful act. Here, plaintiff alleged defendant acted in bad faith and intended to harm by repeatedly sending plaintiff duplicitous requests for verification forms to be completed. Those conclusory statements in the amended complaint fail to allege a malicious act unmixed with any other and exclusively directed to the injury and damage of another. Next is Bauer, Baugher. On page 14, it's a legal malpractice case, and it deals with the criteria for disgorging legal fees. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the complaint stated a cause of action for forfeiture of legal fees on conflict of interest grounds. The court wrote, the complaint seeks forfeiture of legal fees paid to the defendant between January 2007 and August 2009 in connection with the plaintiff's decedent's claim against Wilson for retained earnings. The complaint alleges that the decedent retained the defendant in January 2007 to recoup the retained earnings from Wilson, that the defendant also represented and performed legal work for Wilson on that issue between 2008 and 2009, that the interests of the decedent and Wilson on that issue were adverse, and that the dual representation violated Rule 1.7 of the Rules of Professional Conduct. That's 22 NYCRR, Section 1200. The complaint further alleged that as a result of its previous dual representation, the defendant was disqualified from representing the decedent's estate in a 2009 turnover proceeding against Wilson to collect the retained earnings. Contrary to the determination of Supreme Court, these allegations are sufficient to state a viable cause of action to disgorge legal fees. Next is Monzon versus Porter. It's on page 15. It's a medical malpractice case. It was a motion to set aside the defense verdict. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court over a two-justice dissent, held plaintiff's motion to set aside the defense verdict in this medical malpractice case should have been granted. Plaintiff alleged her bowel was perforated during surgery. The defense expert testified the bowel must be fully inspected as it is replaced section by section. However, defendant surgeon testified he did not fully inspect the bowel. In addition, the jury was asked to determine whether the bowel was subjected to a so-called focused inspection. However, there was no trial evidence equating a focused inspection with the standard of care. A new trial was necessary. The court wrote, the weight of the evidence greatly preponderates in favor of plaintiffs due in no small part to defendant's testimony that he not only failed to perform a focused inspection of the bowel, but that he could not observe it as he returned it into plaintiff's abdomen. In not observing the bowel, defendant plainly could not have conducted a careful visualization of the body part as it was returned to plaintiff's body. Therefore, he was plainly not performing a focused inspection. Defendant also admitted that he didn't specifically look for bruising of the bowel, which his own expert testified is required when inspecting the bowel during a aortobifemoral bypass surgery. Inasmuch as defendant's conduct does not meet the standard articulated by the expert witnesses, we conclude that the evidence so preponderates in plaintiff's favor that the court erred in denying her motion to set aside the verdict. Next is Halloran on page 16, another medical malpractice case, this time involving opioids prescribed for an addict. The first department held defendant pain management doctor, that's Kiri, K-I-R-I, Kiri's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice case was properly denied. Kiri allegedly continued to prescribe high-dosage opioids to plaintiff's decedent, knowing that she was an addict. Plaintiff's decedent died of a drug overdose. Although plaintiff's decedent used illicit drugs as well, there was a question of fact about the proximate cause of death and whether the death was a foreseeable consequence of prescribing opioids. Next is Dickinson on pages 16 and 17, another medical malpractice case, this time concerning the proximate cause element. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court over a two-justice dissent, held that the medical malpractice action against Dr. Dietz and his employer should have been dismissed because plaintiff's expert did not raise a question of fact about whether the alleged departure from the standard of care had a causal relationship with the plaintiff's injury. The court wrote, inasmuch as plaintiff's expert did not indicate the possible results of any examination or testing, whether those results should have prompted a different course of treatment, or how Dr. Dietz's alleged departure from the standard of care otherwise caused plaintiff's injury, plaintiff failed to raise a question of fact as to causation regarding Dr. Dietz. Next is Levere, L-E-V-E-R-E, versus City of Syracuse. It's on page 16. It involves a traffic accident involving a police officer, emergency vehicles, municipal law. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the reckless disregard standard for the operation of a police car in an emergency situation applied to the facts, and also found that the officer's conduct did not rise to the level of reckless disregard. The court wrote, here, the defendant officer's uncontroverted testimony established that he was responding to a disturbance call that was priority one, the highest priority level, and that he took several precautions before proceeding into the intersection against the red light. He slowed his vehicle to an almost complete stop, looked to his right and left, and then slowly proceeded into the intersection at a speed of about 5 miles per hour. When plaintiff's vehicle came into the defendant officer's peripheral vision, he slammed his brake and attempted to avoid colliding with plaintiff's vehicle. Whereas here, a defendant officer takes precautionary measures before engaging in exempted conduct under Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1104, Subdivision B, the police officer does not act with a reckless disregard for the safety of others. In Gutcase versus Delaware Avenue Merchants Group, on page 18, that's another case involving municipal law, the Third Department determined that a municipality's maintenance of light poles is a proprietary function subject to ordinary standards of negligence, which is not protected by the doctrine of governmental immunity. Plaintiff's negligence cause of action, therefore, properly survived summary judgment. That was a cause of action against the municipality. The plaintiff was repairing burned-out lights, which were on strands of decorative lights attached to the light poles. Plaintiff was injured when he fell from a 16-foot aluminum rung extension ladder when the pole that it was leaning on suddenly fell over. Next is Metcalf versus County of Erie, another municipal law case, this time involving the relationship between the sheriff and the county. Fourth Department held the action against the county stemming from injuries and deaths suffered by plaintiff's decedent in the Erie County Holding Center was properly dismissed. The court held that the county is separate from the sheriff's department, which in turn is separate from the sheriff. The county is not responsible for the hiring and training of sheriff's deputies, which is only the sheriff's responsibility. Therefore, the negligent hiring, training, supervision, and retention cause of action against the county was not viable. The court wrote, "The duty to supervise and train sheriff's deputies rests with the sheriff," citing County Law Section 652. "The county has no similar duty. Defendants in this case therefore met their initial burden on the motion by establishing that the county was not liable under the theory stated in plaintiff's fourth cause of action. We reject plaintiff's contention that the county's representation that the Erie County Sheriff's Department lacked a separate legal identity from the county stops the county from contending that it is not the employer of the sheriff's deputies. The county correctly stated that the sheriff's department does not have a legal identity separate from the county, and thus an action against the sheriff's department is, in effect, an action against the county itself. The sheriff, however, is distinct from both the county and the sheriff's department, and thus the county's representation has no bearing on whether the sheriff, as opposed to the county, bears the responsibility of hiring, training, and supervising the sheriff's deputies." The Dunn case is next, and that's on page 20, another municipal law case involving the liability of the county for an employee's acts. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the complaint against the county based upon the alleged negligence of a county employee should not have been dismissed. It was alleged that a coroner, whose name is Jackman, employed by the county, transferred human remains, plaintiff's son, to a volunteer fire company for the purpose of training cadaver dogs. The court wrote, "Although it is generally a question for the jury whether an employee is acting within the scope of employment, an employer is not liable as a matter of law if the employee was acting solely for personal motives unrelated to the furtherance of the employer's business. Here there is evidence that Jackman's decision to transfer a portion of the remains of plaintiff's son to defendant Vincent Salerno, the fire chief of Cambria, was driven by a work-related purpose rather than Jackman's own personal interests. Furthermore, there are issues of fact whether it was foreseeable that Jackman, in performing his obligations as a county coroner, might negligently remove, transport, or even transfer decedent's remains." At this point, I'm going to insert a verification code for this June 2019 negligence update CLE course. The verification code is COUNTY. Again, I'm inserting a verification code in this June 2019 negligence update CLE. The verification code is COUNTY. Next is Rivera on page 21, dealing with the evidentiary requirements for negligence per se. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant Delco's motion for summary judgment dismissing the negligence per se cause of action should have been granted. Negligence per se is shown by the violation of a statute, not as here, by the violation of local ordinances, administrative rules, or regulations. Plaintiffs alleged Delco, a painting contractor, caused a fire at plaintiff's residence. The Second Department held there was sufficient circumstantial evidence to support the causation element of the negligence cause of action. With respect to the negligence per se, the court wrote, That branch of Delco's motion, which was for summary judgment dismissing the negligence per se causes of action asserted against it by the tenant plaintiffs, should have been granted. Violation of a state statute that imposes a specific duty constitutes negligence per se, or may even create absolute liability. In contrast, violation of local ordinances, administrative rules, and regulations constitutes only evidence of negligence. Here, the tenant plaintiffs did not allege that Delco violated any particular state statute. Rather, they only alleged violations of local laws. Next is Christopher J.G. on page 22. It has to do with an open and obvious condition. Fourth Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that the gap in a bathroom stall door at a McDonald's restaurant, in which infant plaintiff's finger was pinched and partially severed when her brother slammed the door, was not an unreasonably dangerous condition. In addition, the court found the condition was open and obvious, and there was no duty to warn. The dissent noted the testimony that McDonald's now installs finger guards, which raised questions of fact whether defendants were on notice the door presented an unreasonably dangerous condition. But obviously that argument was rejected by the majority. The court wrote, defendants met their initial burden by establishing that the stall door did not constitute an unreasonably dangerous condition, and plaintiffs failed to raise a triable issue of fact in response. The affidavit of plaintiff's expert was speculative and not sufficiently probative to defeat defendant's motion for summary judgment. Contrary to plaintiff's further contention, we conclude that the alleged hazard posed by the bathroom stall door was also open and obvious, and therefore defendants had no duty to warn that the door presented a finger-pinching hazard. Next is Matter of 8th Judicial District Asbestos Litigation. It's on pages 22 and 23. Court of Appeals case addressing whether this action sounded in products liability. The Court of Appeals, in a full opinion by Judge Stein, over a two-judge dissent, reversing the appellate division, held that the defendant, named Wilput, which sold coke ovens for steel production, did not demonstrate, as a matter of law, the ovens were not products, triggering the duty to warn. Therefore, defendant's motion for summary judgment should not have been granted by the appellate division. Plaintiff's decedent worked on top of the coke ovens and alleged breathing the toxic substances caused lung cancer. Plaintiff's alleged defendant had a duty to warn plaintiff's decedent to use a respirator when working on the ovens. The appellate division had determined the coke ovens, housed in so-called batteries, were akin to buildings, and construction of the buildings was a service, not a product. The court wrote, defendant has not met its burden in showing that the coke ovens at issue are not products as a matter of law. Regardless of the alterations, Bethlehem, that's the steel manufacturer, may have made to the scale and specifications of the battery at large, the ovens themselves served one function, the production of coke. This process was standard across all variations of coke ovens that Wilput sold, ultimately placing the hazardous thing at issue squarely within the category of products to which liability has attached in the failure to warn context. Wilput was responsible for placing the ovens into the stream of commerce, and it derived financial benefit from its role in the production process. By the time decedent began working for Bethlehem, Wilput had sold hundreds of coke ovens to plants. Wilput also marketed its ovens with informational brochures showing the completed ovens and their functionality, indicating that Wilput, not Bethlehem, was the commercial source of the product. Although the ovens were largely assembled and completed on site, that merely speaks to the logistical realities of the market, of which Wilput had a considerable share. The record supports Supreme Court's conclusion that Wilput was in the best position to assess the safety of the coke ovens because of its superior knowledge regarding the ovens' intended functionality, a major determinant of the existence of a duty to warn is an assessment of whether the manufacturer is in a superior position to know of and warn against those hazards inherent in its product. Next is the Ghent case on pages 23 and 24. It's a slip and fall case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendants, the property owners, were not entitled to summary judgment in this slip and fall case. The defendants submitted plaintiff's deposition testimony that the ice formed sometime between the middle of the day on the 16th and 7 a.m. on the 17th when he fell. The property owner, Santiago, testified he saw no ice on the afternoon of the 16th and saw no ice when he returned to the property at 11 a.m. on the 17th. The defendant's papers, therefore, demonstrated there were questions of fact. The court wrote, in support of their motion, the defendant submitted the transcript of the deposition testimony of the plaintiff, who testified that on February 16, 2016, precipitation had fallen, that it stopped sometime after he picked up his children at their school at noon, that when he returned to the subject property, the driveway was not icy, and that the neighbor whom the defendants had retained to plow the driveway had done so after the precipitation stopped, but did not apply any salt. The plaintiff also testified that on February 17, 2016, at about 7 a.m., he slipped and fell on thick ice that was cloudy and dirty in appearance and which covered the entire driveway. He further testified that the ice started forming on February 16th, either sometime in the middle of the day or sometime between 9 and 7 a.m. on the next day. Defendants also submitted the transcript of the deposition testimony of the defendant, Christian Santiago, who testified that the tenants did not have any responsibilities with respect to snow or ice removal from the driveway. He also testified that he visited the subject property to inspect ongoing renovation work in one of the apartments on the morning or early afternoon of February 16, 2016, that it was not snowing or raining at that time, and that he did not observe any ice on the driveway. Santiago further testified that when he returned to the property the following day at about 11 a.m. or noon, he observed a snowbank measuring anywhere from 4 to 5 feet or 6 to 7 feet high at the end of the driveway created by the plow the day before, that he did not see any ice on the driveway, and that he noticed that there was salt on the concrete landing but not on the driveway. The defendants failed to submit any meteorological data for either February 16th or 17th, or evidence of the condition of the driveway subsequent to it being plowed by the neighbor or within a reasonable time prior to the incident. The evidence submitted by the defendants showed the existence of tribal issues of fact and did not suffice to establish a prima facie case for summary judgment. Next is another slip and fall, pages 24 and 25, the Rivera case. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall should not have been granted. Plaintiff tripped over a wheelchair scale in the hallway of defendant's nursing home. The Fourth Department noted that the issue was preserved for appeal despite the absence from the record of the memorandum which raised the issue. The issue was addressed in defendant's reply papers and noted in the court's written decision. The Fourth Department held that the scale was not an open and obvious hazard as a matter of law, and the fact that the scale was alleged to have been in compliance with the National Fire Prevention Association's Life Safety Code would not be dispositive on the issue of negligence. The court wrote, defendant did not meet its initial burden on the motion by submitting the deposition testimony of one of its employees who opined that the wheelchair scale was in compliance with the National Fire Prevention Association's Life Safety Code 2000 edition. Even assuming arguendo that defendant's employee was qualified to render an opinion concerning defendant's compliance with the code, we conclude that defendant is not entitled to summary judgment because it's well settled that compliance with regulations or a building code is not dispositive on the issue of negligence. Next is Perez, another slip and fall, page 25, this time involving the storm in progress rule. First Department held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall was properly denied. Although a storm was in progress when plaintiff fell, there was evidence there was ice in that area before the storm. The court said, although the meteorological records and the expert meteorological affidavits demonstrate that there was a storm in progress when the accident happened, a warehouse associate employed by the defendant testified at his deposition that he saw ice on the ground about a week before plaintiff's fall, and defendant submitted no evidence as to when the area was last inspected or cleaned before the accident. Next is the Nesbitt case on page 26. It's another slip and fall, and it raised an issue of what kind of records can be requested in discovery in a slip and fall case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant's request for discovery of alcohol/drug treatment/mental health information/HIV-related information in this slip and fall case was not supported by evidence of a compelling need. The court wrote, a party must provide duly executed and acknowledged written authorizations for the release of pertinent medical records under the liberal discovery provisions of the CPLR when that party has waived the physician-patient privilege by affirmatively putting his or her physical or mental condition in issue. However, Public Health Law Section 2785, Subdivision 1, provides that notwithstanding any other provision of law, no court shall issue an order for the disclosure of confidential HIV-related information, and the only exception to that prohibition that is pertinent in this case requires an application showing a compelling need for disclosure of the information for the adjudication of a criminal or civil proceeding, citing Public Health Law, Section 2785, Subdivision 2A. Here, the defendants failed to proffer any showing of a compelling need for disclosure related to HIV-related information. Further, the defendants failed to submit an expert affidavit or any other evidence that would establish a connection between alcohol/drug treatment/mental health information/HIV-related information and the cause of the accident, and failed to make any effort to link any such information to the plaintiff's ability to recover from his injuries or his prognosis for future enjoyment of life. Next is SB on pages 26 and 27. It's a slip and fall, dangerous condition case. It involves an assumption of the risk, and it involves the landlord-tenant relationship. First Department held the out-of-possession landlord's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case was properly granted. Infant plaintiff, named Deandra, had moved some logs from the side of the property and was jumping from log to log when he fell. The court wrote, defendant testified that he had the tree cut down and the logs stacked along a property fence several years earlier and had never seen the logs anywhere else on the property. Deandra testified that he and his friends had arranged the logs in a line and were jumping from log to log when he fell. The record shows that no one had complained to defendant and out-of-possession landlord about the logs before the accident, and Deandra testified that he'd been playing on them for about 10 minutes when he fell. Plaintiffs contend that it was foreseeable that children would move the logs. However, absent evidence of earlier incidents involving the logs or any complaint made to defendant about the logs, the possibility of children playing with them does not render the presence of the logs in the backyard foreseeably dangerous. Plaintiffs also failed to raise an issue of fact as to whether Deandra could fully appreciate the risks of jumping onto logs. As Deandra himself created the danger by setting up and jumping on the logs while playing with his friends, plaintiffs cannot show that he was faced with a risk that was unassumed. Next is Vulo on page 27, another slip and fall involving municipal law and an independent contractor who worked on the sidewalk where the slip and fall occurred. The first department held defendant abutting property owner, that's Hillman's, motion for summary judgment in this sidewalk slip and fall case was properly denied. Hillman had hired an independent contractor to do concrete work on the sidewalk, but that didn't relieve Hillman of his non-delegable duty to keep the sidewalk in good repair. That duty is imposed by the New York City Administrative Code. The court wrote, although the general rule is that a party who retains an independent contractor is not liable for the independent contractor's negligent acts, an exception arises when the hiring party is under a specific non-delegable duty. Here, Hillman, as the property owner, had a non-delegable duty to maintain the sidewalk, including the sidewalk around the subject signpost stump, which apparently is what plaintiff tripped over. Contrary to Hillman's contention, the motion court did not conclude that Hillman is, in fact, liable for any alleged wrongs committed by the independent contractor in performing cement sidewalk resurfacing work. Rather, the motion court correctly found that under these circumstances, the record raises issues of fact as to whether the cement work ordered by this defendant, the property owner, caused or exacerbated a hazardous tripping condition, and whether Hillman had actual or constructive knowledge of the metal protrusion on the sidewalk outside the building. Factual issues are also presented as to whether the condition was open and obvious, or alternatively, the defect trivial. Next is Preston, page 28, another slip and fall involving the open and obvious doctrine, Fourth Department. Held defendant property owner's motion for summary judgment in this wrongful death case was properly granted. Plaintiff's decedent was 96 years old and resided in defendant's senior citizen facility. Plaintiff's decedent was found dead in a pond on the property. The medical examiner concluded plaintiff's decedent may have slipped on the sloping bank of the pond and slid into the water where he died of drowning. The court wrote, a landowner has no duty to protect or warn against an open and obvious condition that is inherent or incidental to the nature of the property and that could reasonably anticipated by those and could be reasonably anticipated by those using it. Here, defendants met their initial burden on the motion by establishing that the pond, including its sloping bank, was an open and obvious condition inherent or incidental to the nature of the property and that it was known to the decedent prior to the accident. A slippery condition on a pond's bank is necessarily incidental to its nature and location near a body of water. The engineering expert's affidavit that plaintiff submitted fails to indicate that it was based on any studies, regulations, codes, or statutes, nor is the expert's conclusion that the retention pond was defective and unsafe supported by foundational facts, such as a deviation from industry standards or statistics showing the frequency of injuries caused by the lack of safety measures proposed by the expert. Next is Matter of Geneva Foundry Litigation on page 29. It's a toxic torts contamination case. Fourth Department held the action alleging negligence and inverse condemnation stemming from toxic contamination of the vicinity of a defunct factory was properly dismissed because the allegations did not specify when the alleged injuries occurred. This is a court of claims case. The court wrote, the state of New York is sovereign and has consented to be sued only in strict accordance with the requirements of the Court of Claims Act. Among those requirements is the claimant's duty to allege the time when the claim arose. The requirements of Section 11B are jurisdictional in nature, and the failure to satisfy them mandates dismissal of the claim without regard to whether the state was prejudiced or had access to the requisite information from its own records. As the Court of Appeals has explained, the state is not required to ferret out or assemble information that Section 11B obligates the claimant to allege. Here, although the claimants adequately specified when defendants' negligent acts allegedly occurred, they failed to supply any dates or ranges of dates regarding their alleged injuries, such as when they were exposed to toxins, when they developed symptoms, when they sought treatment, or when they were diagnosed with an illness. Instead, claimants alleged only the dates of their residence in Geneva and the dates when the news of the contamination became public. Claimants' allegations are insufficient to enable defendant to adequately investigate the claims in order to ascertain its liability, if any. Next is Chaplin on page 30, another toxic torts case, lead paint case. Fourth Department reversing Supreme Court held that defendants failed to demonstrate when the lead paint exposure cause of action accrued. Therefore, the defendant's motion for summary judgment on the ground that the statute of limitations had passed shouldn't have been granted. The court wrote, in moving to dismiss the complaint on statute of limitations grounds, each defendant had the initial burden of establishing the time in which to sue had expired, and thus was required to establish when the plaintiff's cause of action accrued. Here, neither defendant established the relevant accrual date of plaintiff's claims for injury caused by the latent effects of lead paint exposure, and in the absence of such evidence, neither defendant made a prima facie showing that the applicable limitations period had expired on those claims. Next is Queen on pages 30 and 31, a traffic accident case. It talks about a couple of issues, the kind of evidence that's admissible in a case like this, and also the proper procedure when the judge believes the damages were too low. Fourth Department noted that defendant in this traffic accident case should not have been allowed to testify that she didn't receive a traffic ticket. The court also noted that the trial judge properly determined the damages for past pain and suffering should be increased, but that the proper procedure is to order a new trial unless the defendant stipulates to the increased amount. Here the trial judge had unconditionally increased the damages amount. The court wrote, it is well established that the evidence of non-prosecution is inadmissible in a civil action. In our view, however, that was the only error during trial. We conclude that standing alone, the error was harmless, and therefore the court properly denied the motion insofar as it sought to set aside the jury verdict and a new trial on all issues. That's citing CPLR 2002. The court went on, plaintiff further contends that the jury's damages award for pain and suffering materially deviated from what would be reasonable compensation for plaintiff's injuries, and that the deviation was not cured by the court's increase of the award for past pain and suffering. We reject that contention. We conclude that the court properly determined that the jury's verdict for past pain and suffering should be increased to $125,000. And that the award for future pain and suffering did not materially deviate from what would be reasonable compensation for plaintiff's injuries, citing CPLR 5501 subdivision C. The trial court, however, erred in unconditionally increasing the past pain and suffering award. The proper procedure when a damages award is inadequate is to order a new trial on damages unless a defendant stipulates to the increased amount. Next is Fadlala versus Yankee Trails World Tours on pages 31 and 32. It's a traffic accident case. It has some relationship to insurance law and civil procedure. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court over a dissent, held plaintiff should not have been allowed to have more time to serve defendant and amend the complaint to substitute the correct defendant. The action stemmed from a traffic accident involving a bus owned by Yankee Trails. 5 days before the statute of limitations ran, plaintiff commenced an action against Yankee Trails World Tours, a different corporation with different addresses and different chief executive officers. The court wrote, the fact that defendant and Yankee Trails use the same insurance carrier is of no significance in the circumstances presented. Notably, the record reflects that the insurance carrier did not contact Yankee Trails until after the statute of limitations had expired, nor may we consider plaintiff's error a mere misnomer that would allow relief to be granted pursuant to CPLR 305C and CPLR 306B. Upon this record, plaintiff's attempt to proceed against Yankee Trails as an unserved and entirely new defendant after the statute of limitations had run should have been denied, as he failed to obtain jurisdiction over Yankee Trails for relief pursuant to CPLR 306-B, and thus to later amend the complaint pursuant to CPLR 305. At this point, I'm going to insert a verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this June 2019 negligence CLE, update CLE course. Verification code is emergency. Again, a verification code for this June 2019 negligence update CLE pamphlet is emergency. Next is Winter on page 32, another traffic accident case involving emergency vehicles and municipal law. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the municipal defendant's motion for summary judgment in this ambulance traffic accident case should have been denied. The municipal defendants did not demonstrate that the reckless disregard standard for emergency vehicles applied because they did not present evidence that the ambulance siren or emergency lights were in use at the time of the accident. Next is ML on page 33, another traffic accident case involving municipal law, this time involving a notice of claim. Second Department held plaintiff student was properly allowed to file a late notice of claim, which added a cause of action. The infant plaintiff was injured when his school bus was involved in a traffic accident. The initial notice of claim alleged negligence on the part of the city and the Department of Education in connection with the ownership of the school bus. The late notice of claim alleged a cause of action against the city and the New York City Department of Transportation based upon an alleged missing stop sign. A police report was attached to the original notice of claim, and the missing stop sign was mentioned in the report. The court wrote, Supreme Court providently exercised its discretion in granting that branch of the plaintiff's motion, which was for leave to serve a late notice of claim. Although the plaintiff failed to demonstrate a reasonable excuse for the failure to serve a timely notice of claim containing the allegation regarding the missing stop sign, the absence of a reasonable excuse is not determinative, as the city defendants acquired actual knowledge of the essential facts constituting the claim within 90 days after the claim arose and were not substantially prejudiced by the late notice. Next is Tyberg on pages 33 and 34, another traffic accident case involving municipal law. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the city's motion for summary judgment in this intersection pedestrian traffic accident case should not have been granted. Infant plaintiff, then 8 years old, attempted to cross the street to get on his school bus when he was struck by a vehicle. The city submitted evidence that studies of the intersection had been done, which found that no traffic control device was required. Therefore, the city argued, and Supreme Court agreed, it was entitled to qualified immunity precluding the lawsuit. The court wrote, in the field of traffic design engineering, the governmental body is accorded a qualified immunity from liability arising out of a highway planning decision. Under the doctrine of qualified immunity, a governmental body may not be held liable for a highway safety planning decision unless its study of the traffic condition is plainly inadequate or there is no reasonable basis for its traffic plan. Immunity will apply only where a duly authorized public planning body has entered and passed on the very same question of risk as would ordinarily go to the jury. Here, the city failed to sustain its prima facie burden on the issue of qualified immunity. The city established that in response to citizen complaints, it had conducted studies of the subject intersection in 2005 and 2007 and concluded that no traffic control device was warranted. However, the city did not establish that those studies, which took place in summertime, were conducted at times when the subject schools were in session. The city also failed to establish that the studies addressed the specific concern of school children crossing the street to reach awaiting buses, and thus did not establish that it had entertained and passed on the very same question of risk that is at issue in this case. Next is Morgan on page 34, another traffic accident case, this time involving a rear-end collision. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiffs were entitled to summary judgment in this rear-end collision case. The defendants claim that the defendant driver, Flippin, couldn't stop because he skidded on wet metal grating did not raise a question of fact. The court wrote, here the plaintiffs established their prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law on the issue of liability, as the evidence submitted in support of their motion demonstrated that the injured plaintiff's vehicle was stopped when it was struck in the rear by defendant's vehicle. In opposition, the defendants failed to raise a triable issue of fact. The defendant's contention that Flippin applied his brakes but was unable to stop because his vehicle skidded on a wet metal grating on the roadway was insufficient to rebut the inference of negligence arising from the rear-end collision, because they failed to demonstrate that Flippin's skid on known road conditions was unavoidable. Next is the final case in this June 2019 Negligence Update CLE course on page 35. It's Qudsi, Q-U-D-S-I, versus Larios. It's a traffic accident case. The accident occurred in New Jersey. The Second Department held that Supreme Court properly denied one of the defendants' motions to dismiss, premised on lack of personal jurisdiction, pending further discovery, but the motions to dismiss brought by the other defendants on jurisdiction grounds were properly granted. The traffic accident happened in New Jersey. Plaintiff's van was struck from behind by a freight truck leased by Finkel, a New Jersey corporation, and driven by defendant Larios, who was a resident of Pennsylvania. All the plaintiffs were residents of New York. Second Department found that there was no general jurisdiction under CPLR 301 and no long-arm jurisdiction under CPLR 302 subdivision A3, which involves a tortious act outside the state causing injury within the state. However, there may be jurisdiction against Finkel pursuant to CPLR 302 subdivision A1, which deals with conducting business within the state. The court wrote, under CPLR 302 A3, the situs of injury is the location of the original event which caused the injury, not the location where the resultant damages are subsequently felt by the plaintiff. Here, since the accident which caused the injuries occurred in New Jersey, CPLR 302 subdivision A3 does not provide a basis for personal jurisdiction over these defendants in New York. The decision went on to talk about the freight company, Finkel. Finkel asserted that it is a New Jersey corporation with its business address in New Jersey, and Larios stated that at the time of the accident, he was transporting a load for the United States Postal Service within the state of New Jersey. However, Finkel admitted that it had terminals at four New York locations at which it parked its vehicles. Based on these facts, and given Finkel's failure to submit trip logs, manifests, or other documentary evidence to support its assertion that the load Larios was transporting was being shipped within the state of New Jersey and had no relationship to Finkel's New York business, we agree with Supreme Court's determination to deny as premature that branch of the appellant's motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 3211 subdivision A8, to dismiss the complaint insofar as asserted against Finkel, with leave to renew upon completion of discovery. So the Supreme Court correctly concluded that Finkel might be subject to New York jurisdiction under CPLR 302 subdivision A1 based upon Finkel's conducting business within New York State. That completes this CLE course, which is based on the New York State appellate decisions addressing negligence issues that were released in June of 2019 and were summarized on the New York Appellate Digest website. Those summaries were initially posted on the website in June 2019 and have since been collected into a pamphlet entitled the June 2019 Negligence Update Pamphlet. That pamphlet is available on the website, and it constitutes the written materials for this CLE course.